The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
Today, we're welcoming back Bob Johansson to the podcast. Bob is a distinguished fellow at the Institute for the Future in Silicon Valley. He has done forecasts for a wide range of companies, including Procter & Gamble, Kellogg's, Disney, and Walmart. He is the author or co-author of 10 books, and we're really excited to talk to him about his latest book, The New Leadership Literacies, Thriving in a Future of Extreme Disruption and Distributed Everything. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Kelly. Great to be with you.
So I was really struck with a particular story that you told in the book about a moment in history that can teach us today. And this is when the emerging telegraph companies approached the titans of railroading. Would you tell us that story, and then we can talk a little bit about what it tells us?
Sure. Well, this story I've heard over and over again in my life here in Silicon Valley, my life adjacent to Stanford University. Leland Stanford was one of the original so-called robber barons, and as they were laying tracks across the West, they were approached by the telecommunications companies and asked the simple question, can we string wires over your tracks? And they thought about it and pondered, and they thought, yeah, not a bad idea, we'll know when the trains are on time. Hmm. So they essentially gave away the right way for the wires over the tracks, and they had a marginal increase, a marginal improvement in a business that was about to become obsolete or at least altered dramatically, but they missed completely the opportunity to become a telecommunications company. So to me, that's part of the dangers, the risks, the cautions of being successful in a business today. There's so much noise in the present, but there's also so much temptation to just love the things you love so much that you miss an opportunity as it's approached from the outside. So what I argue in the new book is that you got to look 10 years out at least and then work your way backwards, because inching your way out from the present, particularly in this messy, messy VUCA world that we call it, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, just inching your way out, you're never going to get out of the noise.
Right, right. And this really struck me because something I've said for a while is that the greatest impediment to innovation is often success, because we have a tendency to
yeah.
repeat the patterns, right, that have worked for us in the past. And why wouldn't you? Because they have worked for
yeah.
you. And you actually say in the story that one needs to look over the edges of your organization. And I thought about this just in terms of Second City. I'm like, well, what do we love so much about our business that we might miss the major opportunity? And part of it was like, oh, maybe we love improvisation too much, which in essence is one of these sort of free things, right? You can't really own it. You can't own these games or these
yeah.
exercises. We're proficient in it, but so many other people have sort of taken to it. And so when you sort of think about it in that regard, you're likely going to make some different business decisions, which doesn't mean don't go open source, right? But it does mean think tactically, because had they even potentially partnered with the telegraph people, the telecommunications people, that could have altered everything in terms of them and how they could grow as an industry back in the days when the railroads ran the world.
Yes, yes. And now it's so much more complicated and so many more risks, but also so many more opportunities. And one of the big things I realized writing this book is there's an inevitable force now that anything that can be distributed will be distributed. It's just an inevitable force. So in that kind of world, shape-shifting organizations will become much more common. Organizations where there's no center, they grow from the edges, hierarchies come and go. And in that kind of world, you cannot control, and the innovation always happens at the edges. So the best you can do is be very clear directionally where you want to go. So it is important to know right away, but also then to look at those external future forces that could disrupt your right of way, disrupt your clarity.
Right. And this thing about distribution is it's not necessarily easily controlled or controllable at all, right? It's but what we're saying, it's inevitable. It's going to happen. You are going to be distributed. So, I thought this was very interesting because you also say distributed organizations will be used for both good and evil. And in fact, the criminal economy and terrorist groups are disturbingly effective as using distributed organizations already. We're seeing how that works.
Yeah, definitely. So shape-shifting organizations right now, if you said who's best at that, it would have to be the criminals. And even the terrorist groups, some of the extreme religious groups that have kind of ancient theology may have cutting-edge organizational philosophies. So what we need is to understand that in this kind of extreme VUCA world, when hierarchy competes with shape-shifting organizations, shape-shifting will almost always win, except in areas which are slow-moving and relatively predictable, and there just aren't very many of those anymore.
No,
so we have to get good. We have to get better. We have to get great at playing and winning and leading in these shape-shifting organizations that are, for us right now, rather mysterious and often threatening.
Yeah. So for our audience, let's talk a bit about what we mean by a shape-shifting organization. So we understand, and we've talked a lot on this podcast, that, you know, in improvisation, it recognizes that hierarchy is an outmoded idea, the sort of top-down organizational style. And I think most experts would agree, organizational experts. And you talk about, and I know you don't love the sort of metaphor of the fishnet, but it is the thing you use, is that when you can think of your organization more in the terms of like a fishnet, that various things are going to pop up and create their own sort of temporary hierarchies, right? And that, I think that's what you mean a bit by shape-shifting.
Yeah. That's definitely right. And, you know, I used to love the term fishnet. I did a book with the novelist Rob Swigert in 1994 that was called Upsizing the Individual in the Downsized Organization. Hmm. It was done in the time of so-called reengineering. And I think fishnet is accurate. If you imagine a fishnet laying on a dock and you pick up a node, a temporary hierarchy forms. You put down that node, you pick up another node, another hierarchy forms. But what I've realized is that we fell into the mistake here that we call at Institute for the Future Amara's Law. Hmm. It's the tendency to overestimate the impact of technology in the short run, but underestimated in the long run.
Mm.
And this idea of networks, the idea of the network organization, this idea of decentralization, it's been happening in gradual ways, and the introduction of packet switching in 1964, the early core technology of the internet, that's made it possible to create organizations that aren't just decentralized, but are actually distributed. And I decided to drop the fishnet term and bring in the term shape-shifting because I wanted that overtly mysterious quality of shape-shifting. You know, in Harry Potter at Hogwarts, there is a professor, Professor McGonagall, who's a professor of shape-shifting.
Mm.
So there is this kind of magical quality to it. But at the core, it's the technology of packet switching that's making it possible for anything to be distributed that can now become distributed. But it's also, it's interesting, the creator of packet switching is usually credited as Paul Barron, who's one of our founders. I got to interview him before he passed away. And, you know, his original charge was to create a network that would resist nuclear attack. And in those days, networks were very centralized. And if you took out any portion of the net, there was a risk the whole network would go down. So they created this network, and you know, I'm a humble social scientist here describing packet switching. But as I understand it, as you send a signal, it gets broken down into packets. They don't get reassembled till the other end. And Paul originally, in his original paper in 1964, he didn't call it packet switching. He called it hot potato routing. I love that term. I wish that would have stuck. Hot potato routing. So in a world of shape-shifting organizations with the capability for hot potato routing on a global scale, you're going to have organizations which grow from the edges, have no center, hierarchies come and go, and the innovation is going to happen at the edges. That's where diversity will thrive.
And I think what we have to acknowledge, and you certainly do, which is this particular the mindset that one needs to allow this to happen, or to use this and embrace this, is not one that's like where most businesses are at, right? But what you talk about is the generations that are coming into the workforce, and in particular, a generation built on gaming, right, has a different kind of approach. And I love this quote from your book. You say, quote, "I believe that gaming, emotional-laden first-person stories, will evolve into the most powerful learning medium in history. Most kids will be ready for this world. Most adults will not."
Yeah, and this is such a different take. I mean, I am really tiring now of books about how bad the kids are, how iPhones are destroying the world, and how kids are unprepared for the future. In fact, the kids are a lot better prepared than we are. Mm. And I think one of the reasons is because many of them are growing up with video gaming. And video gaming, the interfaces in video gaming, you know, games aren't new. We've always played games. What's new is the interface. Mm-hmm. And the interface is today's video games is roughly 10 times better than anything we have in offices, even if we use Macs or Surface or whatever. So the challenge is, how do we take that technology? And I agree with many parents who have the caution that many of today's video games are too sexual and too violent. But I ask that they look past the content to the medium. Mm-hmm. And this is such a powerful learning medium for immersive learning, and I call it voluntary fear engagement, right, where leaders can create safe zones and go in and practice using gaming, simulation, immersive learning, and be better prepared. Now, the military does this much better than business. There's a few industries like healthcare and aerospace and a few others that in pockets do it well. But the kids know it better than we do. So there are issues with kids and iPhones and learning to communicate in person. I'm not denying those. But we got to learn from the kids as much as we have to correct them. And I think that's part of what I'm trying to promote is cross-generational mentoring, you know, where we learn from the kids. And maybe if we're lucky, we get to play the wisdom game with them.
Right. And I will be so bold as to give an add to that list, that improvisation, military and some of those other that you mentioned is essentially a game-based platform, learning platform. So
definitely.
So what's
definitely.
Right. And so what's fascinating about that for what we sell into the corporate sector at Second City, which is these immersive learning experiences where you can practice getting beyond yourself, practice taking chances and risking, practice controlling your fear. So a lot of the stuff you talk about, and it does, you know, what we talk about with improvisation is that you do it enough and you do experience these failures, you develop resilience. And what I hear you saying, and I believe it's true based on my 20-year-old who's a gamer and sophomore in college, is that those story-based games where he is dying over and over again and needs to come back and do it is actually giving him a similar kind of sort of resilience experience, so that he's not afraid to try stuff and fail and try again.
Yes, definitely. I think you're exactly right about improv. You know, improv reminds me of the military, and I've been, I'm not a military military guy by training, but I have since 9/11 been volunteering to work with the Army War College, and I teach there now periodically, and I work with a number of the senior leadership folks, and I've learned so much from the experience. But they refer to the leadership style that they call commander's intent, or the new language now is mission command or flexive command. And essentially it's based in the fact that in a highly uncertain VUCA world, you want to be very clear where you're going and very flexible how you get there. Now, that fits right in with the guidelines for improv, the way I understand it. You have some directional clarity. Mm-hmm. You build off what the other person says in advance, but you don't know exactly where you're going. Nope. But you're kind of improvising off a basic structure of some kind, but with tremendous freedom within the envelope of improvisation.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. And there's another aspect that you bring up in your work with the Army National Training Center that struck me, because one of the things that we've experienced at Second City over the years is we have an incredibly powerful way of doing real-time feedback. So when our actors are improvising towards content, right, we're writing a show, every night that they're doing those improv sets, they're getting immediate reaction from the audience, and they're adjusting based on if they got a groan, if they got a laugh, if they feel the energy lagging, they adjust. And then they have a director who comes in right after and says, here's what I saw. Bum, bum, bum. Okay, and then tomorrow we'll sort of, deal with it. And you, I'm going to quote from the book, you say, quote, "It surprised me that the military seems able to separate after-action reviews from performance reviews. I've not seen a single company that is able to make that very important separation across the whole company. And unless you do, it's very hard to learn from your mistakes." So that kind of instant improv feedback is an after-action review. And I'll go one step further and agree with you that even at Second City, we haven't been able to figure that out for the rest of the company to avoid the, like, terror of performance reviews, which don't work.
Yes, exactly. So the basic protocol of after-action reviews is fascinating. It's basically what was intended, what happened, and what could be improved. And when I first started working with them, they were developing this database in the sky to capture the learnings from the field, the learnings from battle, the learning from the after-action reviews, and they had this great, big, complicated database. Well, it turned out the database was far less useful than they thought it would be, but what was incredibly useful was the discipline, the protocol, the way of work, the way of thinking that made it just part of daily life to build in after-action reviews. And somehow, when they do this, they can separate it from performance reviews and can build in the feedback, but it has to be practiced on a very large scale. And that's exactly what they do at the National Training Center. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it was an amazing, a life-changing experience for me.
Yeah, I bet. And this is a running theme, right? Which is you're talking about both some really disciplined ideas and points of view that are also matched with things that that are like art. So one of the things you talk about with regard to stories, right, and you say, quote, "Clarity is usually expressed in stories, while certainty is usually expressed in rules. Rigid rules can get leaders in a lot of trouble in the VUCA world, while stories encourage people to engage." And then you say this, and I love it, "Stories sing, rules shout." And this is a theme, right? Which is like there's both things are true. There's artistry involved in improvisation, but that actually can't rule the roost until you have some discipline around your approach to this stuff.
Yes, exactly right. So this future that's emerging over the next decade, this future will reward clarity, but it'll punish certainty, as particularly the certainty of hierarchy. So you want clarity of direction, you want flexibility of execution, but you want to resist certainty. And when I was a doctoral student at Northwestern, we were all taught about confirmation bias, right, and that was kind of the logic of the time, which is it's easier for us to believe things we already believe. Yep. But now modern neuroscience and modern cognitive science, they got a new term. The new term's called my side bias. Mm. And what it means basically is we only listen to people that we already agree with, and that reinforces our certainty. But our certainty, by definition, makes us brittle. So here again, we can learn from the military folks, because oftentimes the politicians in our life come out as being very certain, but not very clear. Mm-hmm. And that just freaks out the military people. They want great clarity, but they want very cautious, very moderate forms of certainty, only in very limited ways. And here I have to say, I'm not an expert in the present. I'm a humble 10-year forecaster. Mm-hmm. But it's obvious to me that we want to grow, we want to enable, we want to facilitate our clarity, but we have to moderate our certainty. And I'm particularly cautious about people who use the word absolutely a lot. If you run into somebody who uses the word absolutely a lot, be really careful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very true. And you actually say, so you say that you're not an expert in the present, and you actually kind of say you're not great in the present, that you're best sort of thinking 10, 50 years out. Have you always felt that way, or is that something that developed over time as a personal view of yourself?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I think it is something that, in looking back at least, I can see I probably had. You know, I've always been awkward at cocktail parties, and I've always been, I could barely make it through airports, and I have trouble with my finances. You know, it's just the daily things are not where I'm strong. Right. Now, I'm smart enough to bring in resources. You know, I have a really good financial planner, and right, I have people who manage me essentially and keep me out of trouble. But I'm not very good in the present. But I did have, I guess it's not too small to call it an epiphany. When I was in divinity school, mm-hmm, I was a research assistant for a conference on religion in the future. And that definitely changed my life. And I said, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to focus my life 10 years ahead. And I've been doing that for more than 30 years now. So I don't recommend this as a psychological profile. But it's worked, you know, it's worked for me. And I've gotten really good at sensing where things are going. It's just, I think you do have to make a choice, and probably it's a more reasonable, sane-inducing choice to be more present-oriented than I am. I'm rather uninterested in the present, except when it reveals signals of the future. And I am very impressed with the William Gibson insight, the future's already here, it's just unevenly distributed. Yeah. So I'm constantly on the lookout for signals. But there's so much about the present that either overwhelms or bores or scares me.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons you might feel a kinship to the sort of improvisational format is at once you have to be wholly present in the moment with your scene partner, because you are creating something out of nothing. That's hugely important.
Yes.
You can't live in the future.
Definitely.
However, you are creating something out of nothing. You are creating a thing that didn't exist before. You are creating the future. And that is unusual, yep, for an art form and exists. And it's funny, there was a Wynton Marsalis quote, and I don't have it at the top of my head, but it's something around the, he talks about in a jazz improvisation, you are having a negotiation with the other artists, and the negotiation itself ends up being the art form. And I find yeah, that's really cool, because it's almost like you're traveling in time a bit with your art, and it strikes me, and one of the reasons I think I reacted to this book so strongly is it is looking at the past and the future and the present all at once, because I think that's the only way. You need that level of sort of, I don't know if you could call it 360, but you need that level of vision to be able to get some level of handle on, okay, where am I going? How am I going?
That's right. That's right. It's essentially living in future tense and leading the future, making the future, leaders make the future. I think that is the link to improv, and it's the challenge. You know, scenario planning is basically putting yourself in the future. So you're actually living as if it was the present. Mm-hmm. But it's actually the future. So you're right. There's a kind of time travel element of this. And when I say I'm living my life 10 years ahead, there's a sense in which I'm I'm living in the present. It's just that it's a fast-forward present. It's a present that has an, you know, I'm kind of a historian of the future or an archaeologist of the future. Maybe that's a better way to say it.
And pivoting off of that in terms of talking about what leaders will need in this future, I thought this was really interesting. You say, quote, "Leaders will need to radiate positive energy at all times. Hope will be the key variable. Young people who are hopeful and digitally connected will be inspiring. Young people who are hopeless and digitally connected will be dangerous. Leaders will need to seed realistic hope in a future that will be laced with fear." Wow, that is stark, but strikes me as probably very, very true.
Yeah, and, you know, this links back to what we were saying about kids and gaming. I think, you know, I've given up on generational cohort analysis. It's taken me a long time. I've really tried.
Okay.
But it just comes out as too simplistic. Mm. But I do think there was a threshold about in 2010, 3 years after the iPhone was introduced. And if you became an adult in 2010 or later, so roughly if you're 21 or less in 2017, you are different. We just don't know how different you are. Mm-hmm. But you're different from a neuroscience point of view. You're different socially. You're different psychologically. And I'm really optimistic about this generation of kids if they have hope. Hope is the key variable. So if you have hope, then you're digitally prepared to amplify that hope, and you become inspiring. But if you don't have hope, and all kids pretty much, you know, used to talk about this quaint notion of the digital divide where rich people had access to tech and poor people didn't. But now, even if you're hungry, hopeless, and homeless, you have some tech. Mm-hmm. And 10 years from now, it's going to be pretty darn good tech. And if you don't have hope, then you become a candidate to be in a terrorist group or an extreme religion or extreme political group. Because the VUCA world is so complicated, many people just can't handle it. Right. And that's when they can become dangerous. So that's really the challenge. But this whole idea of how do you create positive energy in this world, this becomes really, really important. And I've come away from this realizing that, you know, it's always been important to be healthy to be a leader, but 10 years from now, you're going to have to be super healthy, physically, mentally, and even spiritually, although not necessarily religiously. You have to be grounded in the face of the VUCA world. And, you know, I was writing that chapter. I did a talk for a group of CIOs in Silicon Valley, and one of the CIOs in the session, who I just love, a guy who radiated positive energy, is Chinese American by ethnic heritage. And when I told him, when you walk into a room, you've got to radiate positive energy. And he interrupted me and he said, "Oh, you've heard about the chi suckers." And he was talking about chi as energy.
Yeah.
And what he said is, yeah, I bring energy into the room, but there's some people that just suck the energy from a room.
Right.
And you got to deal with that, because for many people, they're just not prepared for this kind of a world. Bob Sutton's got a new book, came out this month, that follows up on his work on these kind of disgruntled, frustrated workers and how negative an influence they can be.
But you can
leaders
use the word if you want to
figure out how to counteract that.
You can use the word. It's the assholes.
You,
I think. You is
what go
Bob
ahead.
Says.
I'm a humble Midwesterner.
Okay. I'm a swearing Midwesterner. Yeah. Bob's book, The No Asshole Rule. It's his follow up on basically tactics, right, on how to deal with that.
Right. Exactly. It's an amazing book, and he's an amazing guy.
Yep.
So he studied innovation his whole career, but he's also studied how negative energy can impede innovation and impede leadership. And that kind of plays into this whole space, and it has to be something we face up to.
So if I'm thinking this out, one of the things I think that is the opposite of hope to me is something like isolation. which I think relates a little bit to your talk around guilds. So one of the things you mentioned in the book is that over time, and this is an ancient concept, right, of having these guilds, these I think you equate them to a term like communities of practice. And we can think about how that might exist for a blacksmith, right? But it's also an improv community, right? That's very much a guild. And they have these gaming guilds now that exist. And I think when we think about what we've lost with the loss of organized religion, especially in these major urban markets, when we think about kids who are drawn to these sort of fanatic groups, it's often kids who don't belong anywhere. They don't have a guild to go to, at least a healthy guild. And I wonder if indeed what leaders need to do in an effort to, you know, provide hope is basically to sort of provide a group and a sense of belonging. And maybe that's sort of the battlefield that we're going to be, you know, on in the future.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, it kind of reminds me as you talk in that language, belongingness. That was the foundation of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And what he was arguing is that you need that base of belonging, and then what he called self-actualization. That was kind of at the peak of the pyramid. In the last two chapters of the book, this whole leadership literacy around creating positive energy, I've looked at all the different approaches to creating positive energy as a leader. Come up with a kind of East Coast strategy, very structured, very competitive, a West Coast, more web-based and neuroscience-based, a global, which is much more belongingness-based and much more natural exercise, and finally an integrated. But my conclusion is there's no one right way to do this. Mm-hmm. You've got to figure out what works for you. But it's very clear that community is at the base, or a guild, or a link. It's a source of meaning for all of us. The challenge is when you think about it with kids nowadays, you grow up in a kid who becomes an adult in this world, believes literally that he or she can connect to any other kid or any other person on the planet. And they're right. Yeah. They're right. Yeah. So at some level, there is an affinity for others, an empathy for others. On the other hand, I really worry about things like cyberbullying and about terrorist groups and others that create communities but form them against others. And that links back to hope. This whole literature about recruiting by extreme religion or extreme terrorist groups, the key variable, the way I read the literature, it's not economics. Economics play a role, but the key variable is hope. And hope links community. So it's very hard to have hope without some sense of sharing, some sense of giving, some sense of reciprocity. And this kind of give-to-get reciprocal culture is so basic. And if you have that, you can be more prepared for the VUCA world. If you don't, to me, the opposite of hope is despair. And if you despair the future, you just can't engage with it, and that triggers a kind of negative force, which can even be violent.
Yeah, absolutely. And you do talk. I should mention this too, because you talk about humor in the book, which is also part of my field. And one of the things that I was sort of tying together is we talk a lot at Second City, and my wife, who's a comedy professor, she talks about ha and aha, because she believes laughter itself is an insight. Because in essence, most comedy is about a pattern upset, you think it's going to go a certain way and it comes another way. And you actually write in the book that collective moments of insights, when people come to the same realization together at the same time, are often the most powerful. And that's exactly what happens when everyone laughs at the same joke in an audience at the same time. It's immensely satisfying because we all had the realization at the same time that something new was introduced.
Yes, exactly. And to me, that's built into, I call it the foresight, insight, action cycle. Yeah. And insight is an aha. that causes you to kind of reconnect the wiring in your brain in a new way, tell yourself a new story. And once you've had an insight, you can't go back. You can't go back. It's much more than an idea. And it turns out foresight is a particularly good way to provoke insight, even if you don't agree with the foresight. It's really interesting. So there's so much energy in the futures field wasted on does the forecasted future actually happen? We don't even use the word prediction here at Institute for the Future. If somebody uses it, we correct them. We even say, well, if somebody tells you they can predict the future, you shouldn't believe them, especially if they're from California. But the point is not to predict the future, it's to provoke insight and lead to better decisions in the present. But to me, humor is a big piece of insight that you're kind of, if you have, there's some kind of a laugh that happens with a group when you say, I get it. And it's often not a, it's not a sort of rocket science. I remember we did a neat project on the future of fun at theme parks right after 9/11 for Walt Disney World. And it was obvious then, the foresight was that gatherings like this are going to become even more important in the post-9/11 world, just for that sense of unity, that sense of community, that sense of engagement. But the parents were really concerned about safety.
Right.
Now, I thought Walt Disney World is one of the safest places on earth, but you had to keep retelling the parents that. On the other hand, the kids wanted to be scared. That's what they wanted. So the insight, the aha that came out of that project was you have to design a theme park where kids can be safely scared.
Right, right.
Safely scared. And you just kind of hear that and you kind of chuckle and say, well, wow, that's putting things together in a different way. But if you go to Epcot, that's exactly what you get in the best of the experiences. They're safely scared. But there is an element of fear, and fear and humor often trigger together.
Sure. And I'm also, your earlier comment about, the concern around certainty and humor challenges certainty. That is
definitely
totally at its root. Like you know, and especially working in a place like Second City, like if you are too certain about something, you are destined for a comic
yeah.
fall, right? No one's going to allow
yeah,
you.
For sure, yeah.
Again, even if you're right, it's just can't happen. And I think that what that builds is a very powerful gene. And I've talked about this a lot, which is, people will be like, how are so many famous people come out of Second City is what they first say. And I sort of reframe it as like, well, what it really is so many successful people have come out of Second City. And it's not related to I didn't cast those people. I wasn't here in 1959 and I'm not doing the casting now. So, it's lots of different people. But what I do think it is this idea of a guild and a practice utilizing humor and improvisation that is sort of nurtured at a very wonderful time in a young person when they are very open to this. And because then they are applying it to their craft in their industry, as they move on, they sort of attract them to like-minded people, probably other people who studied at Second City very often. But really, it's all of that. And so it's sort of, what they really are is developing really great skills for collaboration, group creativity, disruption, and they're natural disruptors, and that serves them well in the future. And I'm not saying that, we need to be. I'm not saying let the world be run by improvisers. I'm actually clearly not saying that. So that's not what should happen. But there is work inside that can be applied to every sort of kind of organization.
Yeah, I agree. And as I look at leadership, and it's interesting, as a 10-year forecaster, I'm using the term leader a lot less, but I'm using the term leadership a lot more. Mm-hmm. And what's important about that change is it isn't just a single leader. Things have really gotten too complicated for single leaders now, that you really need leadership. And the leadership that I think will work in this kind of world combines humility with strength.
Right.
And in most cases, you see the obvious strength in leaders, but you don't see the humor right away. And the humor, the improv, that whole ability, that expresses humility. But you also want that humility in a strong cloak, and the cloak comes out through clarity. It's a cloak of clarity, not a cloak of certainty, but there's continuing clarity. And it's like, you know, to get back to theater and performance, to me, Broadway shows amaze me because it's the same actors doing the same play night after night after night, and yet they do it with incredible energy each time they perform it. And that's what leaders have to do with their clarity day after day to communicate that. I got to work with A.G. Lafley during his first tenure at Procter & Gamble, and yeah, he was struggling then to try to help the company come back from a really big hole we're in. And one of the things he said was R&D has to get much more productive. But he didn't say kind of berate them. What he said is half of the ideas have to come from the outside. I'll measure you. I'll publicly announce it when you reach the goal. And whoever succeeds will write an article in the Harvard Business Review. He didn't say how.
Yeah,
but he repeated that with great clarity. I heard him say it several times a day. And each time he said it with magnetic enthusiasm. Mm. And that strategy that came out, the connect and develop strategy, that's what happened. But he didn't say, you will do connect and develop. He said, here's the clarity. And then he let them play it out. And eventually it was Nabil Sakab and Larry Houston who wrote the article. It was Gil Cloyd who came up with the connect and develop strategy. So I think our job as leaders is to express that strength, that humility. You couldn't go to AG with just one idea. He always wanted to know the span that you were working with.
Right.
But then once he got it, once he had the clarity, wow, he just became the most enthusiastic advocate. But he wasn't just telling people what to do. He was telling people where to go. Mm-hmm. And it was up to them to tell themselves and to create what they do.
And you bring up something else in the book that I think is important in recognizing leadership for the future, which is also the medium, that leaders can no longer be expected to be physically present 24/7 because, again, in these distributed networks, right, there's just no way. And so this idea around creating a mixed media platform for yourself as a leader, I don't think I've seen that anywhere previous to this, and maybe exists, but I was really blown away by that and thought that that is an important way and a new way that leaders need to think of themselves.
Yeah, so here's the clarity on that area. You want to be better when you're not there in person. You want to be better than if you were. And there's a basic set of options, and I got a map in the book about those, and it's all about time and place. So there's same time, same place, different times, different places. You know, same time, same places in person, face-to-face. There's same place, different times. There's same time, different places. And, of course, there's any time, any place. And this gets back to the kids. If you look at that array of options, many parents would argue that their kids are losing or perhaps never developed the ability to communicate in person. And even if they're at dinner, they're looking at their smartphones. Now, there's a real issue there, and Sherry Turkle has studied that, her wonderful book titled Alone Together. There's a real issue there. But to me, that's a negative frame that the adults and the parents come in and say, oh, you kids are a big problem here. The iPhone's such a bad thing. You got to change. Instead, they could come in and say, you know, there's these five different media that combine, five different kind of places of media, place and time. And four of the five, you're better at it than I am. Mm. One of the five, I may be better than you. That's in person. Right. So let's learn together. Right. And I'm going to go there with you into your world and hope you'll teach me about social media and about game platforms. And maybe I'll get to play the wisdom game. And I'll help you understand in person. We all have to do that. We have to create, well, the distributed shape-shifting organizations, they're now inevitable. So the challenge is, how do we use this wild, rich array of media and sensors everywhere to communicate presence in a way that allows us to be close, but not too close? I talk in the book about the uncanny valley that the roboticists have explored for years, where robots are more and more attractive the more human they get till they reach a point. And then they start to look weird or spooky.
Right.
They go down in the valley. So distributed leaders will have that same challenge. You want to be close, but not too close. You want to be better than being there. And again, the kids are more ready for this than we are. So we've got to learn from the kids.
I think that's a great lesson. Okay, so we're coming close to the end of our conversation. I'm not going to make you did a yes and story the first time. I'm not going to make you do that again. But what I'd love to sort of touch on, sort of in close, is the optimistic idea around here. And I agree with you. I look at my children. I've got a 20-year-old and I've got a 15-year-old, and the way they see the world, their idea of what justice might mean, their inquisitiveness, their use and handle of a variety of media around them. I see them, thriving. And I know not everyone has their challenges, and not every kid's like that. But I really am quite positive. And I'm curious for you, like, thinking about the previous generations, like, where did we miss the boat? Like what was are we confounded by the technology, and did that sort of like mess us up? Or as you look in the last, and I'm just thinking like the last 10, 15 years, what were the challenges that got us to the place that we are right now?
Yeah, I think one of the frameworks I use to try to answer that question is, I'm particularly interested in the distance and the time between new technologies that are perceived as impossible and new technologies that are perceived as inevitable, and how fast that goes. If you look at something like hot potato rooting, the internet, and all this global connectivity, that's taken roughly 50, arguably 60, 70 years to be an overnight success.
Right.
And now we're just coming to grips. Mm-hmm. So in a real sense, it's not what's new, it's what's ready to take off, what's ready to scale. Yeah. And the shape-shifting organizations, that's now ready to scale. So we're reaching that level of complexity, and that's what's changing the nature of the future as you look ahead. Now take something like driverless cars. We've studied driverless cars and autonomous vehicles for years now. And if you look back even 10 or 15 years ago, many people would have said, that's impossible. Mm-hmm. And the conversation, even in the futures world, was about smart cities, smart highways. Now, it's inevitable. And the only question is, will it be this year or next year or 2 years? So, and the big shift there was the coming of age of really cheap, really powerful sensors. Wow. That's what changed the game. So I'd be looking at those threshold technologies, and now adding to that how those threshold technologies can be misused in threatening ways. So what's different about this VUCA world? Life has always been a VUCA world, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, always been a VUCA world. Beginning from the fact we all have to die. It's a VUCA world. On the other hand, it's never been so global in scale as it's going to be in this next decade because of global climate disruption, because of various kinds of cyber terrorism, and because of what I'm starting to refer to now as weaponized synthetic biology. On July 17th, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, issued a call for proposals around gene drivers. The potential to use, again, humble social scientists talking synthetic biology, but using synthetic biology to break into genetic structures. Those things are unprecedented at a global scale. So I think that's what's different about today. It's global scale VUCA in a way we've never had it before. It's possible now for a person who's so crazy that we can't imagine how crazy he is. It's possible for that crazy, crazy person to find 100 people on the planet who are just as crazy as he is in exactly the same crazy way, and use the web to amplify their collective craziness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now that's crazy. Mm-hmm. and that's different. That's unprecedented. So I think that's what's happened. That's why I view this decade as a kind of a threshold decade where we're dealing things we've never dealt before. And And it's so confusing that it's people are bound to get confused. And that kind of invites simplistic solutions. It invites certainty where there isn't simplistic solution and there isn't certainty. And that becomes an issue in itself with things like my side bias. But that's what we're facing over the next decade is really unprecedented global challenges. And it's so tempting to say, whoa, slow down, simplify. And that's good unless it becomes simplistic, unless it becomes dangerous.
Right. The book is called The New Leadership Literacies. Everyone should get it. Bob Johansson, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Always wonderful to talk to you. Thank you, Kelly.
Well, I've been working in a home.